Welcome back, and thank you for tuning in to Insight is Capital. I'm your host, Pierre Daly. We like to think we're rational with money, but the reality is most financial decisions aren't about math. They're about mindset, fear, envy, old money scripts. They drive us more than we care to admit. And if we don't face them, we stay stuck. That's why today's guest, Dr. Brad Klontz, is so interesting. He's a financial psychologist, best-selling author, and professor who's spent his career untangling the messy relationship between money and behavior. Growing up in a family marked by financial struggle, he turned hardship into fuel for his mission, helping people rewrite the beliefs that sabotage them and finally build real financial freedom. His latest book, Start Thinking Rich, 21 Harsh Truths to Take You from Broke to Financial Freedom, is a blunt, no-nonsense guide to spotting the patterns that sabotage us and learning how to flip the switch from poor thinking to rich thinking.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Brad, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us.
I'm honored to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you again, and you're welcome. I'm excited about the conversation we're going to have. Brad, before we get into it, your story is powerful. You've written about growing up in a family that faced financial struggles and personal hardship. Looking back, what were the defining moments that not only shaped your relationship with money, but also inspired you to turn that pain into a mission to help others break free from their own money struggles?
Yes, thank you for that question. I'm going through all the files. Where do I start? What incident? I grew up in a family that did struggle financially. My parents split when I was very young, which, you know, we'll take your net worth and cut it in half. By the way, that's my best financial advice is to go ahead and get some marriage counseling, see if you can work it out. But I think that one of the key moments for me was, and I'm so thankful for this, when I hit trouble in my life, my father would be pretty blunt with me. And I remember this happening in my early 20s. I was driving my Jeep. I was actually going to class, and I got into an accident on the road. And I hit a patch of ice, and I lost control of it, and I ended up slamming into a guardrail. And I was really shaken up by this. And I remember calling my father and probably looking for a little bit of emotional support. And my father was like, "Oh, whoa, are you okay?" I'm like, "Yes, I'm okay." And I'm going to tell you, within a couple minutes, he asked me this question. And I think it really summarizes what I think allowed me to take a close look at my relationship with money. And he asked me, "Well, I wonder what you could do differently next time." And this just felt like another slap in the face. I'm like, I just got into a car accident. I hit a patch of ice. What are you talking about? What can I do differently next time? But I thought about it, and I ended up, you know, basically weighing down the back of my Jeep because, I mean, there's all sorts of things, quite frankly, that I did that would decrease the chances of that type of thing occurring in the future. But I think part of the reason that I was able at an early age to sort of really try to flip the script when it came to my family story around money was this sort of mindset that, well, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? I saw my family really hardworking, good people who were broke, poor, didn't have any money. And I remember at an early age thinking, seeing people who were wealthier and having this mindset, well, if they can do it, I can do it. And I think that that mindset, if I could give that mindset to anyone who's struggling with money, if they could do it, I can do it. I think that changes everything.
Yeah, I absolutely love that line of thinking, that problem solving mindset, first of all, and the line of thinking, if they can do it, I can do it. We're so limiting to ourselves, aren't we? Like at times we can self-talk ourselves into the ground if we allow it. And, you know, so to have a turn of a phrase to hang on to anchor to, is very powerful for starters.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we'll be talking about rich mindsets along the way. And this is something I've thought about a lot, but I've also researched it. So I've right. conducted studies because I wanted to actually figure out, is there a rich mindset? You know, and if so, what is it? What is the psychology of wealth? And so the studies I've done, I've looked at ultra wealthy individuals, middle class, lower income, and assessing them with regard to their psychology. And one of the key psychological mindsets that's associated with success is something called an internal locus of control. And with an internal locus of control, your assumption is that the outcomes you're getting in life, so this could be your investment returns, it could be the growth of your business, it could be the struggle you're having in a relationship with a child or with your partner. The internal locus of control says, okay, so I'm having this experience, it's my fault, essentially. Why? What can I do here to change things? It's an extremely empowering mindset. And it is a mindset that separates people who are successful, not just financially, but successful in work, in career, in relationships. It really does separate people who are successful from people who struggle chronically. And so that's, I think my dad was trying to instill that in me. If there's one thing I can instill in my two boys, it would be an internal locus of control.
Yeah, that was something I actually personally came across that in my in the early part of my career. And the reason it struck me as also, you know, something to hang on to anchor to was, I related to it because I personally have a very internal mind locus of control where, you know, my self-talk is about, you know, what comes next, you know, what do I do next, or how do I solve this problem. So now in the book, you draw a clear line between being broke, which is temporary, and being poor, which you define also as a mindset. How do you actually help someone flip that switch when their whole life experience has taught them to expect struggle and disappointment?
Yeah, it is a challenge. And I do think it's very important to make a distinction between being broke, which, as you say, and as I look at it, is a potentially temporary experience. A mindset, though, like if you have a poor mindset, like when I see you rehearsing these scripts around the fact that you're helpless and things are hopeless and you're powerless, and you have an external locus of control. So you are blaming. And by the way, there's no end of people who are deserve blame. I mean, so that's the challenge here. You know, it's predatory lenders. It's a business partner who lied to me. It's my wife who's constantly not seeing how special I am, by the way. This is happening to me right now. It's like, come on, don't you get it? It's so easy to find those external sources of blame. And the challenge is, it's so seductive. It feels so good. It really does. I mean, you might feel irritated to those people, but wow, it relieves me of responsibility. It soothes me. When I was growing up, one of the money scripts that my family had was that, you know, rich people became wealthy by being greedy or selfish or taking advantage of other people. And if that's what you believe, I'm going to tell you right now, you can look around and find many, many people who fit that description. And I think it was dangerous, but it was also so great because here we are struggling financially, but at least we're not one of them. And yes, they look like they're having a better experience and all that, but deep down they're evil and they must be miserable and they must really be unhappy. And so they're not as happy as we are. I mean, so it's called a confirmation bias when you have that type of belief and you're just looking around for evidence to support it, and you disconfirm and you discount evidence that would challenge it. And I see this all the time on social media too. When people have this like money avoidance, rich people are greedy mindset, you could tell them something like, oh, this billionaire's going to give away 95% of their fortune. And they'll be like, yeah, but it's, you know, they're just doing it to save money on taxes. And when you do the math, you're like, well, actually, you're losing a lot of money by giving away 95% of your money. Maybe you're saving some taxes, I guess. But it just sort of reinforces this belief. And so that is the biggest challenge, I feel like, is when you're steeped in a poor mindset, you have surrounded yourself with other people who look at the world exactly the same way. And the biggest challenge, I think, is for you to then try to like move away from your tribe. I mean, before we hit record, we were talking about how so many people in the US seem to be okay moving cities and moving in different places. And I feel like if you want to go from a poor mindset to a rich mindset, it's almost like you have to go to a new tribe, a new area. And a lot of our functioning around money really does come down to our prehistoric tribal brain. And so we sort of surround ourselves with people who think just like we think. And the dangerous part for us psychologically is if we get kicked out of our tribe, if we move away from our tribe, every cell in your body is going to tell you don't do it, because for your ancestors, it meant certain death. And so it helps explain, and I know that many people listening are advisors, and I'm an advisor myself, and it really does help explain why people who come into sudden large sums of money, the typical response is to self-sabotage and basically go right back to where you were. And that looks crazy from the outside, but if you think about it from an evolutionary psychology perspective, it makes total sense. It's like you have now removed yourself from the tribe. People are looking at you differently. You may be losing your friends. So people try to bring up the entire tribe, and who doesn't know how to manage money, by the way. So they end up squandering it quite often. Or you just feel a sense of guilt and loneliness. And so that's why it's easier for people to hold on to wealth when they get it slowly over time, because they have to learn different things. They have to learn a different way of looking at things. They have to work with advisors. Like when I grew up, we didn't know any estate planning attorneys. We didn't know any CPAs. We didn't know any financial advisors. So this was a whole group of people that, why would we trust them? We can't trust anything they say. And so I think it's a process to really develop that rich mindset. And if you get the money before the mindset, things usually don't go well.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the best examples is what happens to a lot of lottery winners. You know, they get thrown into the swimming pool and then they don't know how to make, you know, maximize what they've received. And then the next thing you know is that, you know, everybody's hitting them for it. I remember, you know, reading in a Tony Robbins book very early on, I think Awaken the Giant Within. One of the things he said that struck me that I didn't understand then, because I was in my early 20s, was, you know, do what you have to, do all the things you have to protect yourself legally, right? And I thought, you know, why would you have to do that, right? And then I realized eventually it was because, you know, we live in a very litigious society. You know, if somebody wants to sue you, they can. If you do something, you know, they can come after you for what is clearly yours, right? And so, but those again, to your point, you know, estate lawyers, tax lawyers, you know, advisors, if you don't have one or you never had one in the first place, you can't possibly know why they exist professionally.
Yeah. And if they're not a member of your tribe, there's a sense of distrust. Like, are you taking advantage of me? What? Yeah, and it really creates a tremendous amount of anxiety. And so then what you do is you go to your uncle, and then your uncle tells you the story about how grandpa was swindled by somebody. And then you're like, oh, I can't trust those people.
Yeah, exactly. There's, you know, pitfalls that don't necessarily exist become this new reality in your mind, right? I want to come back to the internal locus of control. You push back on the idea that capitalism is hopelessly stacked against ordinary people. How do you walk the line between acknowledging very real systemic barriers and convincing people they still have the power to change their financial lives?
So I actually am agnostic around capitalism. Like, I'm not an economist. I have no opinion about what is the absolute best model for, you know, how we run the government or the economy or whatever. I feel like what is, all right. And so here's the issue though. I see people get really mired down in the concept that they aren't getting where they want to get, and they're born where they are born into because of capitalism. And okay, fine. That's fine. But what I start to worry about is, and therefore the system is stacked against me personally, and there's nothing I can do about it. It's that last part that bothers me. That's the only thing I really have an opinion about, is that, and there's nothing I can do about it. And are systemic barriers real? Absolutely. And by the way, there's a whole bunch of them. And if you look at me right now, you can see that although I'm very attractive, I'm also a white male. And there are certain barriers. By the way, I'm also a heterosexual male. I'm come from a Christian background. I, you know, English is my native language. I'm able-bodied. I mean, I have an entire sort of assortment of things that we would call privilege in psychology that's unearned because you're just born this way. Now, I didn't grow up with economic privilege, but for every checkbox you have that you don't belong to the majority group in whatever culture you're in, there's going to be some systemic barriers along the way. And so what I always encourage people to do is if you look at somebody like me and you're saying, yeah, capitalism is easy for you because of X, Y, and Z, fine. I get it. And you're probably going to make some really, really good points after that that I would probably agree with. But then I would also encourage you to do is to find somebody who, this goes back to what we talked about earlier, that comes from a place where you came from, has faced similar barriers, has overcome those barriers, and is further along the path or has already achieved the life you're wanting for yourself and for your family. And study them, study their mindset, study the barrier. How did they deal with these systemic barriers to get where they wanted to get? How did they do it? So find somebody where you can say to yourself, oh, okay, fine, fine. If they can do it, I can do it. That's ultimately where we need to get to. And actually, my co-author on Start Thinking Rich, good friend of mine, happens to be of Mexican descent, and his parents got here in a really, really difficult way. And so there's some people who can identify with him as a child of immigrants who are, you know, of Mexican heritage, more so than me. And that's fine. But I just encourage you to find somebody who has that internal locus of control, has been able to navigate those barriers. Because if you can get to that mindset, well, if they can do it, I can do it, it really does unlock everything. It's like your brain opens up, your subconscious opens up, and you're going to start seeing opportunities that you didn't see before because you had shut the door, because you had told yourself, because of this and because of that, success is impossible for me.
Yeah, I think you know, when people get to that spot, it's almost as though you get this feeling that a secret door was opened for you. How come I never knew this or saw this before? You know, and now it's fascinating. It's fascinating stuff. You mentioned the laundry list of privilege, and there's also a cohort of folks out there who feel that that's the opposite, that it's not a laundry list of privilege. It has become a laundry list of disfavor as well. I mean, so they're walking around with the opposite belief of what you just provided as a laundry list, like paradoxically, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just like they're walking around with the idea that rich people are evil or more stuff equals happiness. All these scripts that we're playing in our minds are quietly potentially wrecking our financial futures. When you look at your work as a financial psychologist, what's the most effective way you've seen people uncover and rewrite those deeply ingrained beliefs?
Yeah, I feel like we do benefit our clients and ourselves when we just recognize that as human beings, we're just wired to do everything wrong when it comes to money. And this is my baseline of human nature and money. And so if I run across somebody who happens to be great saving and, you know, disciplined investor and has thought about plans for the future and they've done all that, that's the abnormality. Like, I mean, it turns out to be good for you when it comes to your financial health and your ultimately your net worth. But that's the abnormality. We have spent most of our time on Earth in those small hunter-gatherer bands, and who've been really focused on, can we live till tomorrow? And let alone next week, let alone 5 years from now. Are you kidding me? 5 years from now, that it's such an abstract concept and nobody's motivated to do anything related to that unless we overcome our natural hardwiring. So when we think about cognitive biases and all the mistakes we make when it comes to investing that we see clients make, that we are vulnerable to ourselves, we're terrible when it comes to money. Okay. Then you stack on top of that your unique upbringing around money. And some of that might have been good. You might have been taught that it's important to save and invest for the future. Many people weren't. And so I think one of the most powerful, important things you can do is to think back into your family history around money. And you mentioned money scripts, and these are beliefs we have about money. These are typically developed in childhood. They're quite often passed down to us generationally, and they have a profound impact on our financial behaviors and ultimately our financial results. And so doing that deep dive in your family history is very, very critical. And part of my story too, I'll just as an example, I got out of school, I owed $100,000 in student loan debt, and I found myself day trading because I saw a buddy make $100,000 in a year day trading. And I was like, wow, this is what rich people do. I'm good at this. I had a great run for a few months. Then the tech bubble hit.
Right.
And then I just watched my money melt away. And that's when I started to dig into my family history. I'm like, okay, why would a reasonably intelligent person do something so dumb? So I interviewed my mother. I interviewed my father. And I found these stories that dated back to my grandfather, who went unbanked his entire life, died in his 90s. I was really close to him. I didn't know this. I knew that he didn't have any money. But he lost all his money in the Great Depression when the banks collapsed. Just understanding that that was my family history, all the cards started to fall into place. It's like, oh, no wonder my mother was so anxious about money. No wonder she would only invest in CDs. She would never invest in stock market. No wonder I came along and just did something radical departure. I knew I didn't want to be like them. So I just did the exact opposite, which was just as bad. You know, in terms of losing my money, no wonder I did that. No wonder I did that. So to make this conscious for you and to actually for your clients too, is dig into the family story. Like, and for a lot of my clients on the advising side, they're doing pretty well with money. They're doing pretty good with money. And so the way I bring it up is I'm like, wow, so you've been saving and investing for several decades. Most people don't do that. And by the way, they're going to nod their head. They're going to be like, oh yeah, I get it. And most people don't. And I'm really curious about like, when did you learn that that was important and who taught you that? And it's a great opportunity for them to reflect on something that many people haven't really ever thought about. And they can talk about how they were taught that. That's a great way to start opening that conversation with clients. And it's really important to do for yourself.
Yeah, I agree. The probing is very important. You know, you mentioned, you know, your grandfather living through the Depression. That was a defining moment for that entire generation. And you know, then there's the quiet generation that followed. You know, that followed or you know lived during the war, during World War II. And subsequently, I mean, those defining moments. Those are the stories that get passed down, right? Those are the sentiment and the feelings and the psyche that gets passed forward. And if you haven't grown up in that, you're left wondering, why do you feel that way? Why do you think that way? Why are you so scared? Or why are you so distrustful? It goes to your point as well about, you know, getting away from your biases, you know, discovering, you know, I don't want to live the way I've always been told this is how people live or that I've witnessed. You get into harsh truths and tough love in your book, and you don't pull any punches. You tell readers things like, you tell readers things like, get rid of your poor friends if you want to get rich. Only broke and insecure people flex luxury brands. Why was it important for you to take such a blunt, confrontational tone in your book? And how does tough love move people in ways softer advice doesn't?
So I have been
shaking them up, right?
Yeah, and it's like I just told you about my father, right? And my co-author Adrian had his father told him, hey, it's not your fault if you're born poor, but it is your fault if you die poor, son. And it's sort of like you know, shakes you up. But these really are like fundamental truths. At least I strongly believe it. They're harsh truths, of course. I am a psychologist, And so, by the way, I wouldn't start the session telling you that. Because you'd still am out the door. But eventually, what I would be doing if we were in psychotherapy is I would be getting you to a point where I would then tell you that. And I would tell you this, and I've told many hundreds of kids this too. Hey, you're going to end up in prison if you keep hanging out with your criminal friends. And I'm going to tell you right now, if you are hanging around with people who have a poor mindset, you are going to be poor and you're going to be broke forever. And it's just utterly true. Remember too, I'm talking about a poor mindset. Like, you could be hanging around with somebody who has no money. But I know you can spot these people right away too, but you talk to them for 5 minutes, you're like, oh, that person's going to be a multimillionaire. Like, they have a rich mindset, even though they have $0 in the bank account. So it's really not a judgmental statement towards people who don't have money. I didn't have money. I may not have money 6 months from now. Who knows? So it's not really disparaging, quote, poor people, but it's really attacking a poor mindset, like, unapologetically. Because it's the poor mindset that needs to get eradicated, as far as I'm concerned, because being poor sucks, which was the first chapter of the book. There's nothing pleasant about it. It's a terrible experience. And I think that it's something that's utterly unnecessary. This book, too, is really the manual I wish I had when I was a kid. That was sort of the inspiration behind it. It's like, and each chapter title is designed to be that harsh truth I give you after we've established rapport, I've heard you give me all your excuses about why it's everyone else's fault, and I understand that, and people hurt you, etc. And then at the end of it, it's like, okay, got it. So now what are you going to do about this? And that is a message of love. A message of me not caring about you, frankly, would be like, oh yes, it is capitalism. You're set up to fail. There's nothing you can do about it. Unless these other people step in and change your life for you and give you money or, you know, whatever, take over the government and give you all the things they promised you. And by the way, I'm old enough to have seen presidents come in and just promise that they're going to help poor people. And when you look at the rates of extreme poverty in the United States, ever since I've been born, they have not changed at all. And so who knows if they could have gotten worse, better. All I know is that whoever's coming into politics is promising to just make our lives so much better, especially if you don't have money. And I just haven't seen it happen in my lifetime. And so I'm glad early on I realized you better not wait. You better not wait for them to solve this problem for you. Yes.
I'm from the government. I'm here to help you.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, it'd be great if you did, but I'm just not going to count on it. I'm not going to wait around and count on it. And even in terms of capitalism, what we talk about is that the best way to look at it is that it's a game. Like, this, you have been thrust into a game. And whether it's socialism, capitalism, communism, there's a game being played. Whether it's entrepreneurship, whether it's you're a government employee, whether you're an employee of a corporation, there's a game being played. Whether it's, you know, high school, college, you want to become a professor, it's a game. And so if you want to do well in the game, you should study people who are doing well in the game. How are they thinking about it? What is their approach? How do they deal with conflict? How do they achieve their goals? How do they overcome these barriers? That's really the mindset shift that I think is crucial, is looking at it like it's a game.
Yeah. And to reframe the question a little bit, it's not so much about moving away from poverty as it is moving towards wealth. I think Jim Rohn had a great quote, which speaks to a lot of what you're saying as well, which is, you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. So if you want to increase your batting average, start hanging out with people who are, above your station.
Yeah, hanging around with your golfing friends isn't going to increase your batting average, you know? I mean, what game do you want to play? What game do you want to play?
I love it. So you describe in your book three common ways people become millionaires. The employee path, the Silicon Valley style entrepreneur, or just entrepreneur period, and the grinder or slow hustler. Based on your research and experience, which path feels most realistic for everyday people? What makes it work over the long run?
There's some evidence to suggest that the majority of millionaires, at least in the United States, are employees and professionals. And there's some pretty solid evidence around that. And if you've ever been an entrepreneur, you can understand why, because the failure rate is pretty high when it comes to starting businesses. Now, I'm pro-business. I own several myself. I've had many more fail than are doing well right now. You really have to have sort of a mindset for that. But I feel like
have to work for it too.
You got to work for it. You got to want it.
Yeah.
I feel like it's this really, really dangerous, terrible information that is all over the internet. And I get really upset when I see young people consuming this. And that is that you're never going to get rich unless you take huge risks, unless you become Elon Musk, or whoever's in favor now in terms of the ideal entrepreneur. Unless you do what they did, you're never going to get there. Meanwhile, the reality is like 70 to 80% of millionaires in the US, what do they have? They have a job. They have a W-2. They go to work every day. They have a 9-to-5, or they're professionals. They're dentists. They're lawyers. But what they're doing is they're saving and investing a percentage of every dollar they make. And if you do that, and I've run the numbers, by the way, you can work in the fast food industry at the counter your entire life and retire a millionaire. That's the message that I think people need to get. And it's okay to be an entrepreneur, because if you want to become a billionaire, you probably do need to go that route. If that's your goal, you're probably not going to get there by, you know, working for a company or being a dentist, although it's possible. But I think that the dangerous message is that you have to do these outrageous things and you got to take huge risks to get there. And that's okay too. And we do talk about the slow hustler, which really personifies, I think, a lot of people who are entrepreneurs make that jump. Like I became a millionaire working in a public school before I made the full leap to full-time entrepreneurship. And a lot of people end up doing that. And I think it's a great way to start along the path of accelerating your journey towards financial freedom. Is you've got your day job that's funding your life. You're also saving and investing a percentage of every dollar you have there. And then you're developing side hustles. You're pursuing other entrepreneurial adventures. And by the way, you can live your entire life that way. And for me, for many years, it just really, really helped, because I was feeling somewhat discouraged that I wasn't getting where I wanted to get as fast as I wanted to get working in the public schools. But I had these side hustles and they fueled my energy and my passion. And I was able to expand my reach and really sort of scratch that itch. Then you got the Silicon, entrepreneur who got lucky. And so I live in a place in Boulder here where there's a lot of people who got really lucky. Now, the bottom line is, did they work hard? Oh, absolutely. Were they smart? Of course they were. Was their business a great idea? Absolutely. But even most people who have all this together don't make it big. And so there's an element of luck that's involved there. So yeah, that's the way to get there. And I feel like those first two are really available to anyone. Like, become an employee, become a professional, save and invest percentage of your income. You're doing, you know, you've got a job and you've got some side hustles to help increase your income so you can save and invest more.
Yeah, I really appreciate, you coming, bringing it or breaking it down that way, because there's a lot of fantasy out there, first of all. And I think it doesn't matter what you do to earn money, as long as it's a living, at least a living wage. Like, that's where your starting point is when you're in your 20s, entry level. But the reality is that it boils down to, financial success, being able to save money, first of all, boils down to one very simple idea, which is simply to spend less than you earn. And we're prone to, chasing illusions, chasing the luxury brands, wanting to adorn ourselves with signs of success. And lifestyle, even if you're incredibly successful financially, even moderately successful financially, you're still prone to, so the earning side You may be successful at earning, whether it's $50,000 a year or $5 million a year. But then on the psychological side that we're really talking about today, you're prone to lifestyle creep, spending increasingly more and more money the more you earn. And still, and then looking back and saying, I have just earned, you know, millions of dollars over the last 10 years, and I have very little to show for it. So what's the problem behind that person? Like, well, that person has all the odds in their favor from an earning standpoint, but psychologically they're killing themselves, they're sabotaging themselves because they're prone to the insecurities, the things that drive them to spend money on things that are not important, as opposed to taking that same money or part of that same money that they're spending on their lifestyle and setting it aside for 10, 15, 30 years from now.
Yeah, I believe that income skills are very different than wealth skills. And it ideally, you have both. But I know people who have very little income skills who are wealthy. I mean, to me, that's sort of the key. So there's a game to how can I increase my income? Do I need more education? Is there a certain profession? How many side hustles can I have? By the way, I've always averaged about 3. And it's like, okay, that's great. But we all know people who make hundreds of thousands a year. I know people make $1 million a year and they have very low net worth because it just gets spent. And why does it get spent? And I think part of it is that people don't really understand the psychology of actual self-made wealthy people, which I've studied and I've done research on it. And I'll give you an example. So we did a study and we looked at people who had a average net worth of $11 million. And we compared them to a group of people who had an average net worth of $500,000. Now, you're doing great with $500,000, frankly. I mean, you're solid upper middle class. But essentially, this group had around 18 times more money than the middle class group. And then we asked them, how much money did you spend on your last car, your last vacation, your last house, and your last watch? So those were the questions we asked them. And you would expect that they spent 18 times more money, but they only spent twice as much. And that blew me away. I was shocked. I was like, wow, think about that for a second. And it really does tell me that that's how they became wealthy. They didn't have this spending mindset. They had a different reference group. Because we're back to the tribe, right? And so we're very much wired to look around. We tell people, you shouldn't care what other people think. Well, that wrong. Everyone cares what everyone thinks. This is how we're wired. So you have to understand that that is inside your psychology and you're very, very vulnerable to it. And so when you're looking around, your subconscious is going to be picking up on what the people in your neighborhood have and you're going to subconsciously want it. I remember during COVID, I came to my wife with a proposal, as I'm accustomed to doing, on what I'd like to see us do. And I said, honey, you know, like, I think we really need a Sprinter van. And I had great ideas for it. By this time, I already had the drawings, you know, how is it all going to be? And she's like, a Sprinter van? What are you talking about? which, you know, good. Glad she said that, or I would immediately gone out and got one. But I was thinking about it, her question, and she kept questioning, you know, she just wouldn't say yes. It was very annoying. And then one day, I was walking to my office. I live in a beautiful spot where I can ride my bike across streams, across the mountain to get to my office. And so I was going through the neighborhood and I saw a Sprinter van. And I thought to myself, I wonder how many of these. I started counting. So from my house, 1.5 miles to my office, I counted about 12 Sprinter vans that were parked outside. And I talk about this all the time. I research it. It never crossed my mind that that's why I wanted a Sprinter van. And when I got to number 12, I was laughing out loud at this point because I had constructed this entire internal narrative that, by the way, was very sound. Like I had really good arguments about why this made total sense, financial sense, how I could resell it. But what had happened is I desired this because of my prehistoric tribal brain, because other people had it. And on a very basic level, it was essential to my survival is how it felt. Like, I just felt like we really needed, not just wanted one, we needed one. We really needed this thing. And it just crept in there. And that happens to all of us. And most people aren't thinking about this. And they just know that, oh, I should get this car. And it's very subtle. You know, sometimes it's flashy watches and that kind of thing. For most of us, though, it's a little bit more subtle. And it's like, oh, well, we should go on that vacation. You know, and we're not sitting back thinking, can those people even afford it? I mean, the average American is in terrible financial shape,
right,
carrying massive amounts of debt and credit card debt. And if you're trying to play that game and keep up, that's not how people become wealthy. And that's not the mindset that's associated with wealth.
Hilarious. That's hilarious, Brad. You know, I those Sprinter vans, especially the ones that are fully adorned, that are fully, you know, equipped, are pretty cool. I remember seeing one walking along the street in Manhattan and thinking, that's cool. A black Sprinter van with beautiful, you know, leather seating and wood furnishings inside. It was like a yacht, right?
You know what? I want you to talk to my wife after we're done with this.
I can see where, you know, you start cooking up all the rationale for doing that and thinking, God, it would be so great if we had one of these. We could go places in it. We could do, you know, it reminds me like completely, you know, of something completely comedic in, you know, the movie Step Brothers, where they, you know, they stack their beds and make the bunks and say, wow, we got all this room now. We can do all these extra activities.
Right.
But we do talk ourselves into these things, don't we? We don't even realize like where it's coming from or who's governing that thought process. That's hilarious that you realized, you know, riding your bike or just going from your home to your places of work, to your office, that your brain was collecting these signals. Subconsciously, you're collecting these signals and talking yourself into doing these kinds of things that they're completely unnecessary.
Right. And, you know, in all the research I've done too, we have found different factors that are associated with healthier money beliefs and less healthy money beliefs. And a couple ones we found is like the more education you have, actually the better you are when it comes, and the older you are, luckily there's some wisdom that comes with age is what we found. And then also being married is associated with healthier money beliefs. And I think it's because if I was single, I would have just gone and bought it, you know, but I had to run it by somebody who's like, can we really afford that? And where would we put it? Like that, she had some really strong arguments. Like, how are we going to drop our kids off at school with that behemoth of a vehicle? Like, it won't even fit in the parking spots. But I had it all figured out about why it all made total sense. I think that's actually why an advisor can be super helpful too, frankly, is where you run your latest great investment idea by a third party who can sort of help you think through it, because you're all emotional about it, because this is your money and you see the path to wealth, or you see that how this is really going to have an impact and it's going to make your life so much better, this material object, which we know doesn't really pan out. Like over time, stuff doesn't make us happier. As a matter of fact, all the studies show that people who are addicted to stuff, not only do they have less money over time, but they actually have more depression. They're actually feeling less happy. So even though we know that, we think in the moment, this is going to change everything and just make my life so much better. And it's really that hard wiring from our tribal brain that was really focused on survival. Like how people, your status within a tribe of 100 to 150 people was a matter of life or death. And it could be like that you had too much stuff. And so what you'll see in a lot of indigenous tribes is that having too much stuff is really, really bad for your social status. And so if you want real social status, they even have some tribes even have ceremonies where you're giving away and you're sharing what you have. And that helps you get status. So just understanding, though, that the desires, the things we want, the trades we want to make, et cetera, so many of these are really wired in that evolutionary psychology that was built for survival, and it's not always in our best financial interest.
Brad, throughout the book, you frame money as more than wealth. It's really about freedom, choice, and impact. For someone that's stuck in the earn, spend, repeat cycle, what's the first practical step they can take to start treating money as a tool for freedom instead of just survival?
I'm always trying to catch people as young as possible because it's so easy. It's so easy if you have the right framework before you get your first job to just set yourself up to be a multimillionaire. It is so incredibly easy. And the mindset really is pay yourself first and automate that payment. And if you do those two things and then just don't do anything radically stupid, you are going to become extremely financially successful and more successful than 9 out of 10 people just by doing those two things. It's more challenging if you're hearing this and you're like, okay, great, Dr. Brad, sounds great. But, you know, I'm in my 30s or 40s. I've got the house payment. I've got cars. I've got all this stuff. I can't afford to save and invest a penny. That's more challenging because it's going to be a little bit more painful for you. So the first thing, though, is you have to accept that I am going to start saving and investing a percentage of every dollar I make right now. And even if it's 1%, if I can get somebody to just save and invest 1%, if you think about all that you need to do to make that happen, you have to go, you know, you have to find a place to invest. You have to decide what you are going to invest. You have to then hook up your bank account to an automatic contribution to that or whatever. I mean, you're going to put the pathway in place that is going to actually make you wealthy someday. And then you work to increasing that percentage over time. So maybe you're going to double it. It's 2%. Maybe you get a side hustle. And now in terms of your percentage, you're able to put 5 or 10% of your pay away. That really is the mindset shift that people need to make.
Simple. I mean, that's classic advice, Brad. That is, you know, that is classically simple. But when you reframe it in the context of the conversation we've had, it takes on a whole new aura.
You know, yeah. We did a study too, where we tried to increase people's savings rates. And one of the key elements that's missing for so many people is that they don't have a really super exciting vision of why they would want to do this to begin with. Because what you have to do is you have to override your biological wiring to consume right now. That this is how we've survived on Earth, is consume, not save, consume. And that translates to money too. And so in our study, we got people to increase their savings rates by 73% after 1 hour of visualizing what it is they wanted. What is it, you know, what does retirement look like for you? Don't just say the word retirement. It's too abstract. It's not motivating. How can you get a really exciting vision right now that triggers your emotional brain, that you're thrilled about, that you want to share with people? And that applies to any financial goal. So once you get really excited about it, there's one other key element, and that is to automate it. Because if you, and by the way, those are the two most powerful pieces of advice I can give, is pay yourself first and automate it. Because when you automate it, you take out the other cognitive, barriers, frankly, to your success, which is, oh, I got to put in effort each month. And one of the worst things you can do is to wait till the end of the month and then save what's left over or invest what's left over. Because I will guarantee you this, you will have nothing in there because you're a human being and that's what happens. And this happens to me too. If I look at my bank account, I'm like, oh, we've got, you know, X amount of thousands in there. I'm immediately going to spend more today, like just plain and simple, because there it is. And so that's why I think it's so important to, if you pay yourself first, meaning it's not in your checking account anymore. It's someplace maybe you don't even see that's being automatically invested. You're going to forget about that. You're going to become accustomed to whatever bucket is left over. I don't care how much money it is that's in there. You know, if there's 500,000 in your checking account, you're going to spend 500. If there's 100, you're going to spend 100. It's all going to be gone. And you will become accustomed to that. And you will totally forget about this. And then months later, you'll be like, oh my gosh, there's tens of thousands of dollars in there. Wow, look at that. I love opening up my kids' college funds because I don't pay attention to it. I automated that years ago. I don't even know how much is going in there. And then I look in there every year or two. I'm like, wow, we're making tremendous progress. And I've done nothing. I made that decision 10 years ago, and I haven't even thought about it since, yet this goal is being crushed. Automation is really powerful.
Fascinating. I was thinking, you know, if you ask people what they want, like it can be a simple, what do you want for dinner? They can rhyme off a laundry list of what they don't want. You know, oh, do you want to go for Chinese? Do you want Italian? Do you want No, I don't want that. No, I don't want that. But I think people are very, it's very easy. It's like it's, you must have run across this psychologically in your studies that people can rhyme off a laundry list of things they don't want or what they don't like. But when you ask them what they do want, like for example, what do you want out of life? What do you want from your life? That is, you know, one of the most difficult existential questions for people to ponder. But if you can actually get them to, as you said, you know, go through this visualization exercise, what is the objective of why would you want to do this automatic saving? Why would you want to, why would you set yourself up to pay yourself first? It's kind of a hack around that problem that people, you know, have a short-term bias.
Yeah, we have a short-term negative bias because our ancestors who sat around optimistically thinking about a wonderful future and not being worried about the immediate threats right now, they all died off. Like they never made it to pass on their genes. And so that's why you have to sort of trigger yourself and actually take time to do it, because you're automatically going to be thinking about the negative.
Fascinating. Brad, any parting thoughts before we wrap up?
I guess I would say that if you are having the life that you want to have in every area of your life, great. And by the way, I'm super happy for you. I'm not even going to tell you you're in denial. Who am I to say that? That's fabulous. If there is an area of your life in which you are not experiencing optimal happiness and success as you define it, that is when you need to open your mind to the concept that perhaps you're thinking about it all wrong.
Wonderful. Dr. Brad Klontz, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and insight.
Thanks for having me.